Amateur Presentation.
Welcome back to another Untitled Movie Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Matt Rohrbeck, alongside, he's allergic to tomatoes, but he is tomato meter approved, Eric Marchin.
Hey there!
Here comes the Spider Boys! What's going on, man?
Not much, Matt. We are talking about your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man today on the show.
Yes, all 10 episodes. So this will be spoiler free. So I will say that, you know, if you don't want to know anything before you watch the show, then maybe bow out. We're not going to spoil any major plot points, any character reveals, anything like that. We will be very, very vague in our critique of the show. But I just wanted to put that out there because usually with these kind of Marvel series, we get 2, 3, maybe 4 episodes. But I was surprised to see that they gave us the entire first season of Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man. So the release strategy is interesting. They're going to be dropping a couple episodes each week. So you'll get the first, I believe, 2 or 3 episodes.
I think it's two.
As you're listening to this on the 29th. So you've probably either seen those first two episodes or you're about to watch them. And then you'll be getting a couple episodes each week for the next kind of month plus. So yeah, we will be talking about the entire season, but I just want to kind of, I'm stalling in case people want to drop out. We're not going to spoil anything though, or we'll try our best not to spoil anything. Eric, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Matt. You know, we're at the beginning of the year. So in terms of new TV shows and movies, the quality maybe is questionable for, you know, the doldrums of January and even into February, when you get something like this that is, you know, without spoiling our full thoughts, but we did react to it a little bit online. There's something really wonderful about getting something early that you feel animated when talking about it, you know, if you'll pardon the pun. But there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the legacy of Spider-Man, but also how I think Marvel animation is more successful and consistent with their projects than the live action division.
And at least lately.
But I think even as a whole, you can do so much more with animation, whether it be the style of this show, which is 3D cell animation that I think a lot of people maybe are confusing or mixing up with rotoscope, because it's not rotoscope per se, but it does have similar qualities in terms of character movement and design and what have you. But, you know, you look at this, you look at X-Men 97, the Spider-Verse movies, you know, whether
a couple episodes of What If,
a couple episodes of What If, scale and scope and how these shows play with the original medium it comes from and adapting it and making it fresh and remixing and retrofitting everything. There's something exciting about this that I don't get always from the live action stuff. And we'll go more into detail, I think, as to maybe like why something like this is more successful, even just like on the basis of nostalgia. But I was fully engulfed by this. I was completely engaged by the material. There was nothing about this show that felt really unearned. You know, obviously there's an aspect of it that is a little bit like maybe on the nose or emphasizing certain things, but you have to take into consideration, you know, there is going to be a younger audience for this as well. And so maybe they're considering, you know, kids are watching this. So we have to emphasize, like, you know, when Aunt May is driving Peter to school after he misses the train and they're talking about Ben, and then you see her ring and then the ring kind of shine. It's like they're emphasizing the fact that he's not in the picture anymore. And it's like those things are like, okay, you know, grown-ups watching the show probably don't need that to understand. Also, we don't need to be told Uncle Ben is out of the picture because we get it, you know?
But this will be a lot of kids' first Spider-Man introduction, and, right? And, just like the 90s series was, or the 60s series was, yes. or the Spectacular series was, or whatever, right?
Or that's why Spider-Verse for some kids, yeah. you know?
And we've seen this origin over and over again, so I get that from our perspective, but I do that the storytelling, I think, has a good balance of adult and spoon feeding for children. Yes. I would say too.
Yeah. And you get that throughout the season, I think I'm more weirdly lenient or like, at least I can allow those things for, not because it's a kid's show, but because it's animated, but because it is a TV series, you kind of have to get your point across in a broader fashion, where I think mm-hmm. film, you can be a little bit more nuanced and kind of find, you know, visual language to tell you certain things. Absolutely. Without, yeah. you know, subtext being the text. Here, you know, I can let that go. As long as it's clever, or as long as they find like an interesting path to follow. And here they really do, especially with, you know, Peter Parker's story, but the way that it is played parallel with Lonnie Lincoln, who, you know, for most people, like, Tombstone is a character that, like, I remember a little bit from the 90s series, but he was usually just like a henchman.
Yeah, exactly, right. Dude. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, yeah. So, overall, like, I would just say, like, the series works really, really well. Is it on the level of X-Men 97 or Spider-Verse? I don't know, but I think it is very high in terms of what it's spinning and how it projects the world that it's built. And like, this is basically what if should have been.
I will echo everything that you're saying. I think that this is phenomenal. I think it's a wonderful, much like what we said from No Way Home, of it being a celebration of live action Spider-Man or Spider-Man in general. I think you can apply almost the same thing to this series, but from an animation side of Spider-Man. To your point, we've seen Peter Parker's story, Spider-Man's story, I feel like hundreds of times at this point, if you've been a fan for all 30 plus years of your life, like both of us have, or even longer, because Spider-Man's been around a long ass time. And with that first animated series being, you know, it was the 60s, right? When that first series came out. So I think this show, is phenomenal to start. I think it's up there with X-Men 97. It's up there with Spider-Verse. Yes, maybe it's not as good as those two things. I think it's maybe too early to say. Come back in season 3 and talk to us. But I think even from its premise of being a remixed MCU, in the sense of what you're saying of what if should have been, it's like, what if Norman Osborn was Peter's mentor instead of Tony Stark, is like the simplest kind of log line of the show, right? But then what the show does with its animation, its theme song, its characters, its everything, is just kind of paying, you know, homage or celebrating the history of Spider-Man in animation, going back with kind of a 60s vibe that's playing off the MCU, doing those cel shaded animation, the theme song being a remixed version of that OG Spider-Man animated series theme, and then the whole show playing off that remix theme. I think it is so perfect, and its characters and what you said, Eric, about superhero stories, like, they play so well in animation. We've seen it with Invincible recently. We've seen it with X-Men 97. When you do these big budget, like, treat them seriously like superhero shows, but in animation, it's one of those things where anything can happen at any point. It can be comic booky and silly with, like, you know, comic accurate costumes, and you can have characters come in, like, I won't spoil cameos throughout the show, even though they've kind of revealed some of them in the marketing and the Comic-Con panels and things like that. But much like X-Men, you can build these universes and have anyone show up at any time, which makes them all feel big and important. Where in a movie, there's so much that overcomplicates things, whether it's budget, whether it's schedules, whether it's, you know, whatever. When you're building this big shared universe out, you can't just have X character show up at any moment. You can't have a 17 different villains, or if it feels too much because it's in that, you know, 2 hour plus runtime. But when you have 10 half hour episodes, so about 5 hours, 4.5, 5 hours of storytelling, and you're doing it in animation where your imagination is endless, right? Where you can basically show anything and it's never going to feel unrealistic or silly because it's comic booky and it's in animation. And I think the show does such a good job throwing everything in there that you know about Spider-Man or you've seen in other Spider-Man series, but slightly gives each thing a twist. And then that's that what if element, right? Is like, it feels like the MCU, and it even plays on moments that if you're a huge MCU fan, you'll recognize a character, or you'll go, that moment's from Homecoming, or that's from Far From Home, or that's from No Way Home. But the way that they introduce characters that you've either not seen in the MCU or put a spin on each thing, I think is that, you know, it's an overused term, but that fresh but familiar feeling that you're like, okay, for hardcore fans, you're going to notice these things, but it does feel completely fresh. Like, I could see Tom Holland's Peter Parker doing this in live action, but this Peter Parker is his own. And I think, you know, I could go on forever. And
as long as Tom Holland was available scheduling wise,
yes,
because it's not beholden to the actor exactly themselves. Like obviously, and you mentioned, you know, I think we can say this because it's been in the marketing material, you know, Charlie Cox voicing Daredevil,
yeah,
but it doesn't have to be Charlie Cox voicing the character, no, but you can, but still, it's cool, bring that the it character is,
yeah,
in. And that's what's great about animation, right? Like, you can bring in a talented voice actor to do the role, and it doesn't have to be, you know, this person who, like, in live action probably has like 3 or 4 other movies and has to schedule
cost
around
too
it
much.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, maybe has kind of parted ways with the franchise for a little bit because they've just spent too much time with it. So, you know, they don't have to worry about those aspects in telling the story. And it's not just simply like, okay, well, if we're doing the live action version of this and we can't get this character, then we're going to have to get this character. And maybe this character doesn't make sense, but this is who we have available to us, where it's not like that at all in any of this narrative. Like, it feels like everything that, whether it be the characters, and it is character driven in terms of
yeah
conflict and in terms of plot. Like, it's not convoluted. Like, it's convoluted in the sense of like all these movies and TV shows are, whether it be superheroes or blockbusters, or, you know, there are some things where like the science or some of the jargon may be a little bit dense, but everything comes from character choices. It's not just simply motivated by like, oh, well, you know, this is happening, so we have to, you know, do X, Y, and Z and get this MacGuffin. Like, it's really coming from, you know, Peter putting people first and other people first, everyone before himself, and, you know, having that responsibility, as we've seen time and time again with that character, but also seeing that parallel story with Lonnie Lincoln in terms of what he yeah has to do and what he has to sacrifice, and how, you know, like you were talking about the what if change or the tweak and how it throws everything else off. It's the same thing here, where just that little sort of difference, you know, can be both familiar, but add a new wrinkle in the continuum of what the storytelling is doing. Even with Norman Osborn being the Stark stand-in, feels like, okay, there is a similarity here of like, you know, because of Norman Osborn, we have Doc Ock as a main villain. And it's the same thing when in the live action movies, Tony Stark is really responsible for both Michael Keaton's Vulture and Jake Gyllenhaal's Mysterio. And then you have, you know, Tom Holland's Spider-Man coming in to be the cleanup crew to clean up Tony's mess, you know, or the things that have fallen yeah out because of him. This feels very much in that same view. And even with, you know, the gender swapping or race swapping sort of characters, like, all of that works. Like, I can see the criticism coming from a certain pocket of
yeah
fandom in the way that Star Wars fans, some Star Wars fans are. But we've gotten to this point now where we've done so many iterations of Spider-Man, and yeah. even comic book movies, that changing things up and diversifying and creating a little bit more inclusion is a good thing. You know, like, these things all work for the story, but they also add new complex emotions and development to these characters that we have not yet seen before, and feels very authentic to the perspective of who they are as people and as characters. And so when we're watching, you know, Peter's journey, we're seeing Harry's journey as well. Yeah. We're seeing, you know, I think a big sort of theme throughout this whole season is never judging a book by its cover. You know, we look at Peter and see him as this kind of nerdy, scrawny type figure, but then the other side is that he's, you know, the one defending Queens. And then with Lonnie, we see someone who is a jock, who's popular, but has insecurities and is extremely smart and, you know, is self-aware mm-hmm. about what he wants to do and what he wants to be, but then also, you know, puts his family before all else and makes some choices that maybe are irrational, but, you know, you understand where he's coming from in the moment. And yeah. so all of these things play really well in terms of development and, you know, emotional connection to the characters, because I think, like, that's going to be another talking point that we can get into. When you were telling me, because you were texting me when you were watching the first few episodes before I started, you were mentioning that some of, like, the action is a little bit maybe janky or a little bit more kind of
maybe not even the action, just some of the animation outside of the action, which
some
I
of
think
the movements
happened,
and references. Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's that bad, because what I was thinking was going to be the level of Joel Haver, the rotoscope artist, okay. because yeah. there's an episode of Smiling Friends that has that style makes, of yeah. animation, and that is truly rudimentary. Like, that is by
no,
design.
This is still very polished, yes. but I think just when you do that cell shaded kind of, it doesn't look like flash animation or something like that, like from the early 2000s or late 90s. But like it doesn't, like, I like the art style quite a bit. Like I yeah. really love, I think the production design and the character designs are phenomenal. I think, like a lot of these animated shows, Invincible's poked fun at it and things like that, a lot of the budget and animation focus goes into the fight sequences, so you can see that those look really polished, where I think sometimes when two characters are talking or walking and talking, that's where it can look slightly janky, but the jank never, it added this charm to it in this show that never bothered me. Like, I'd prefer this over like What If's style, right? Which yeah. I think What If has some of the same issues when it comes to the animation, but I think that's just from a, you know, how things get made, where the focus needs to be put into, where I think the design and colors and everything in this show is so vibrant and interesting looking. Like, it's one of those things where they really embrace that comic book style, whether it's from the editing and how the panels kind of flow into one another. And I think from the animation and from the look of the show, really kind of nails that as well. So yeah, there were times where I go, ooh, that doesn't look as good as this, but it never bothered me as I continued to watch the show.
Yeah. And also I think, like, it thematically works because of it being the freshman year of the hero, of the main character, you know, spreading his wings and learning to fly, figuratively speaking, or swinging in this case.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that jankiness actually works in terms of him being an amateur hero, right? Like, it's him finding totally. his way and finding, you know, the experience that he needs in order to be a little bit more polished in his own performance or in his way that he approaches things, even to the point where, you know, there's the development stage and the design stage of, you know, the different suits that he's wearing. In one sequence, which really works quite well. And I thought it was actually very funny in terms of how branding is presented in that sequence.
And even how a CEO comes up with the worst ideas ever.
Yeah.
To like, and then forces them on everyone, and everyone's, this is a terrible idea. Don't let you do anything. Yeah, I thought that sequence is great. The use of the different costumes, like kind of showing some of the history of Spider-Man in the comic books and the different outfits that he's worn, which you've seen a lot in like the video games and things like that. But in the movies, we've pretty much, I mean, I know in the Homecoming trilogy, we've seen, you know, Peter wear a few different costumes here and there, obviously. And that is a very Spider-Man thing, is to completely change his costume frequently, yet always go back to that OG costume. But then always kind of experiment with different things. That sequence is fantastic. The sheer amount of characters in the show, I was surprised at how much we got and how balanced it felt. Like, to your point, it's very much Lonnie and Peter's story, that juxtaposition between the two, and yeah, I never thought they'd get me to care about Tombstone, right? Like, I just I remember Tombstone and in the comics and in the 90s series and things like that, but even when they were introducing Lonnie in the series, I'm like, why do I recognize that name, but I don't know. And then you're like, oh, the character's Tombstone. And and if you're familiar with Spider-Man comics and things like that, you would immediately know Lonnie Lincoln is Tombstone. But just like his friend group with Nico and Harry and the little spins that they put on all of that, and having
which Amadeus is basically Cho. Ned and MJ.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Everything is that perfectly remixed kind of thing, right? Where it feels familiar, but is completely fresh. And then you have his intern friends with Amadeus Cho and Jean or Jeannie and Amadeus Cho, people who are, I don't know if these are spoilers because they're comic book things, like they're very known of what that character is, but if you've made it this far, we're going to talk a little bit about comic history and who these characters are. But if you don't know anything about these characters, you might want to bail out. But Amadeus Cho being totally awesome Hulk in the comics, and just building up this universe of doing its own thing but pulling from the comics, I think is great. I think Paul F. Tompkins as Bentley Whitman is great. Like, he's so good in this.
He's kind of like that old little, you know, craggy dean that is like, yeah, you know, like, how dare you kids like misbehave. And again, like, it goes to the point.
Coleman Domingo is amazing too.
Yeah, absolutely. Coleman Domingo, like, it that is interesting as well, because you have more like classic voice actor performances and actors, you know, in these roles, but then you get a Coleman Domingo, you know, in a significant part that is, you know, a two-time Academy Award nominee, but it doesn't feel any more distracting or takes away from anybody else in the performances, and it's not, you know, like, it's appropriate for Norman Osborn, and it does feel like you need like a big name for such a significant and influential part,
yes,
to play. And so that like really, really works. And I love the back and forth between, you know, Parker and him and that mentorship that develops, and, you know, still feeling like he's looking for a surrogate Ben figure. Cause that's the other thing that this show talks about in an interesting way. And Aunt May brings this up a couple times, that she wishes that Ben was around because, you know, maybe Peter needs somebody to confide in, and, you know, maybe get a therapist. I mean, that's all the ultimate thing, yeah. You know, but you need somebody to talk to about what's going on, you know, whether you're a superhero or, you know, working 9 to 5, like, I think sometimes people just need someone in their life that they feel like they can come to at any time and say like, hey, I need to talk, or I need help, or, you know, and that's like part of the process of this show is really getting into the psychology of those characters and, you know, learning about, like, you know, a good support team or a good support group, I think, is vital for anybody in keeping them grounded. And you see that with Nico and Harry for Peter, you know, and how that can be, you know, something where I think Peter also sometimes feels like he has to protect those people, and so he keeps them at an arm's length. And it's the same thing with Lonnie, where, you know, you're frustrated because you want them to reach out and say, like, you're smart enough to know to ask for help. But then there's this feeling of obligation that you don't want to involve somebody and get them in trouble or, you know, put them in harm's way. So there's a lot going on you know, with those complexities, and even just like the conversations that Lonnie has with his younger brother, Dre, you know, like you feel, you know, this sense of, okay, this feels very much like how two brothers would interact in terms of like how they see themselves. And, you know, it can be both selfish, but then also, you know, trying to be the bigger man in the situation, or to be the one that is trying to do what's right by everyone else. And even though maybe you're not thinking like really what is the right thing to do, you're just going with what you know is your best option or what you think is best. And those are things that I think play out really well in this show that, you know, I think any drama or any, you know, good TV show, whether it be comic book, you know, animation or just live action dramedy, like, you know, these are really relatable themes. And I think with that, you can understand these characters in this world as much as the traditional format in which it's been presented before. And, you know, you can recognize the 60s series, you can recognize the 90s series. They're there, you know, the legacy and the lore is all a part of it, but it's also feeling like, okay, well, now we know all of this, let's move on and let's try to do something that is, you know, representative, but still relevant to what is today. And when you're watching it, that's what you feel. And, you know, that's the exciting stuff with comic book movies, or with, you know, this version of it, at least, where these themes and ideas and representations are all there, and they work, and they work well because they're beautifully written and they're thought out. And, you know, like, I think if what if was like a season of one storyline with one superhero that was like this, it didn't have to be a continuing series, it could just be still an anthology series, but one whole season following a character and not just one episode. Yeah. I think that would have better suited What If in terms of its lasting power.
I agree with you, but I think the silver lining of What If is getting things like this. It's letting the animation teams, even though, you know, completely different teams, I think, working on that show and this, when it comes to the I mean, it's still Marvel Studios animation, but, you know, them seeing what works and what isn't. Not that we got like a backdoor pilot for this show in What If or anything. It's not a spinoff of What If. It's just like the concept kind of comes sort of from the What If idea. But I think with What If, it lets them, you know, even I think the lead actor here, Hudson Thames, did the voice for Peter Parker in What If, yes. Correct?
Yeah.
So I think things like that is them going, you know, brainstorming probably during What If, and even maybe coming up with this idea while they're doing that show, and then goes, that's a good enough idea that we can do our own thing there. And that can be its own animation style. That can be its own thing. So I think we got three seasons of What If. It's over now. You guys know our opinions on that. We reviewed them and mixed bag overall, some episodes better than others,
but that's anthology in general, right?
Yeah. But I hope what comes from that is that they see with X-Men 97 and this show, and that I assume great reactions both shows are going to get. We don't know exactly from the social media sentiment from the people who got these early episodes. Everyone's really, really liking it almost as much as X-Men 97. But I think the future of Marvel animation are those two shows. And I'm excited to see what they do with that Wakanda show. And I forget, we got the Marvel Zombies show coming out, and it does seem like they're focusing more on stories within their own universes. And I think that is the right move, because you can build out, you know, what a multiverse should do is like, I want to care about this version of this character, this universe. And I think both of those shows have done a great job of including the wide amount of Marvel characters you can have in a Marvel universe, but each being its own thing. And this is completely, eliminated my want for Spider-Man 98. Like, I don't need that show anymore after we've gotten this. I just think Spider-Man can show up in X-Men 97, and then X-Men 97 is your 90s universe. This is your kind of remixed MCU universe, right? Like, yeah, I can't
with a
wait 60s for people
to vibe to it still.
Yes,
it's got this style.
Exactly. Even when these other characters show up, and I don't want it, like, there are some great surprises in this show. And there was a couple of them in these last couple episodes, and even throughout, when you know characters are there and are coming because you've seen some of the marketing or the panels and stuff like that, I just think the sheer amount of people who show up and what they involve, and going back to that fresh but familiar thing, it's so, even though it's animation and it's so easy for them to draw a character and get someone who sounds like a certain actor to show up, it still like makes this universe feel big and important because it's based off of this big and important thing that they've already built. Right. And that's what's exciting about Marvel and animation is, like, again, going back to the imagination has no limits thing, is like you can build off of moments you've either already played out, but then completely do different things. And, you know, as the story goes on and certain characters get involved, and how you find out how Peter gets bitten by the spider in this universe, which I will say I'm a little, I guess it's just a branched reality based off of one thing, but for that one thing to happen, the other thing needed to happen. So I don't understand how.
Oh, you're getting into a paradoxical situation.
Yeah,
here.
So
the chicken or the egg, right?
So maybe when we do a spoiler cast or something, we'll talk.
I know
about
what
that
you're saying. I thought about the same thing. I like the idea of it in terms of, you know,
maybe
like
they'll explain it more
circle moments, and I'm being cryptic here, but like the concept of it isn't bad. Like, once you start to think about it and poke holes through it, it's like, okay, wait a second. How does this really work?
It's a superhero.
Exactly.
Thing. You're like, it's one of those things where you're like, for a second. Peter is so
analytical and scientific minded, you know, like he thinks things through.
You think he would go, how does this make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, the other character that is a big part of that, does kind of bring that up of it being a branched reality. And maybe because this is post Loki season, post TVA pruning different branches, you assume that, you know, that one universe, Peter,
post prune,
and then it spawned a branched reality. So I don't know. You don't overthink it, is what it is. Even though it will trigger some of those thoughts with like any time travel-y stuff happens, you're like, okay, how does that make sense?
Well, that's like, where logic flaws do come into play, and I think like that's where you can poke those holes in reality to a certain degree. But then also you have to, as you just said, you know, you put aside those things because I don't think like that's its first priority. Like, it's just like, it's a way in order to, you know, get this sort of to come full circle and to tell this story in a way that feels like, okay, we're getting to that point in like, how does this
universe different? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that. I do it's not a bad idea. Like in terms of execution, it's just the logic flaws do play a role in, you know, deciphering it. Like, I think like if it was a show where the character wasn't a science nerd, I think you would probably give it a complete pass because it's just like, oh, well, you know, it's just a phenomenon. But I think because there is such a science heavy component to this narrative, just in terms of the character's interest, but even, you know, the world building and the design and how everything is created within the concept of it all, that's where you begin to start thinking about it a little bit more and dissecting certain parts of it. But then you realize, okay, there's a guy wearing a literal scorpion suit, you know, menacing Peter Parker. And there's some pretty dark stuff in this as well. Like,
yes, that's what I mean. Same with X-Men 97. Remember, there are a couple of things in X-Men 97 where I'm like, oh crap, this is pretty adult. And yes, the show could be for children, but there is some adult or dark stuff in this.
Well, even the violence, like when it needs to be, there's a couple of moments in this surrounding a certain character where violent actions occur. And I kind of did a bit of a, oh shit moment with one shot in particular, but even with, you know, like, obviously, like, Tony was dealing with this in Iron Man 3 with post-traumatic stress disorder. We see that even in this show in terms of, you know, have Peter having to pick up the pieces. And, you know, the mentorship between Norman and Peter, I think, is really important because ultimately, while Tony is not perfect by any means, you know, I think he's able to adapt based on the mistakes he makes, and he's able to find, you know, that humanity within himself, but within also the other characters, where Norman is not as forgiving as a personality. And, you know, when he pushes Peter to his breaking point, you see parts of that character come through that are like, okay, well, this is a person that is a little bit more ambiguous when it comes to his values and his morals and, you know, what he's willing to do in order to win. And that's where, like, the cutthroat businessman part of it comes through. And there's this great sort of two-hander, this back and forth in one episode between Doc Ock and Norman Osborn that basically sums up opportunists perfectly.
It's so good, dude.
It's amazing.
And shout out to Hugh Dancy as Otto, because, like, that this version of Otto Octavius, I think, is fantastic. And, you know, we got just enough of him in this season to kind of, you know, set it up for the future. But I think he's fantastic as this kind of sort of pathetic but genius, but, like, kind of, I don't know, this kind of super nerd kind of, I don't know how,
but doesn't have like the means of industry to, you know, have the same level of power or the profile of Norman Osborn or Tony Stark or Bruce Banner, but he still is brilliant. It's just that even that is interesting, because there's a lot of really talented and smart people when it comes to, say, film criticism or criticism in general, but maybe don't have the outlet or the profile that other people do. And so
that's, like, in anything, right?
It totally is. And that, like, I feel is a very universal thing, where not that people turn into Doc Ock and you know, go nuts, but there's a feeling of, like, oh, like, I get this. Like, there's, you know, like, there's the conversation between substance versus style, and Norman Osborn being maybe more of a capitalist before he is a scientist or interest, like, he's probably still interested in the science, but maybe that's his second or third priority.
But knows how to building play the empire. Knows how to play the game and, you know, manipulate people, or just kind of, where someone like an Otto, who, you know, thinks the world is against him and he hasn't gotten the same opportunities. But it's a very fun Doc Ock performance, for sure.
Well, that one line with the helmet, I think, is really funny, where he's explaining, like, what it does, and it's like, oh, and it shoots lasers.
Yeah, like, he's got this weird, like, very different than, you know, Alfred Molina's Doc Ock and some other Doc Ock performances we've gotten. Like, he's kind of awkward, but, like, funny or quippy in the sense, like, more than I've Doc Ock maybe. And Doc Ock's always had fun lines and stuff like that, but more playful, weirdly. Like, and that goes to the cartoony comic booky kind of vibe of the show, and even him being in that comic accurate kind of. Oh, another thing I love that they kind of poke fun at too is the very animated series thing of everyone wearing the same clothes all the time. Like, yeah, there's a great moment where Peter wakes up, he's in bed resting, and he's wearing a t-shirt and boxers or whatever, or pants, and he goes to his closet and he looks at a red shirt or something, and then throws it away and puts on the same yellow and blue hoodie with yellow vest that he wears every single episode. And I think that's really fun, where it never tries to be realistic, right? Yeah. Like, it's realistic in what you said of its characters and their interactions and their progression and how, you know, brothers would interact or friends would interact or mentors and mentees. But, like, when it comes to everything else, it embraces its animation and comic book roots, where this is the character's outfit, and this is what they will be wearing no matter what. When Otto, Otto will be in that green jumpsuit and lab coat no matter where
when he's in prison. There's a scene where he's in prison for the first time and he's still wearing that green suit.
If he goes out to dinner, he's probably wearing that lab coat.
But that's with everybody. Like, that's with Nico, that's with Norman. Like,
what I mean.
It's with everyone. And to your point, like, it feels like that's very much almost like, you know, even the costuming of the suits, like, it's the human version of that, or their, you know, alter egos just being like, okay. And it saves the animators some money, I think. Like,
and that's why they've been doing it. Look, The Simpsons, you know, in everything does it, right? Like, every animated series, it would be way more of a pain in the ass if you had to make the characters wear different outfits all the time. And that's just that's an animated television show thing, right? It's just, I think in most TV shows, your character has your outfit and that's what you wear, unless it's like a special event or something like
that. But even then, I feel like some of those characters would still wear what they're wearing in those scenes. You know, another thing you mentioned, like, there's like fun little details that are Easter eggs, but maybe not necessarily ones for comic books, but just like even what, like, on what's on Peter's nightstand. Like, you see White Fang, a book on grammar and a book on presidents, you know, and it's always there, and, you know, or he's reading it, or it's, you know, opened in maybe some episodes, but still on the nightstand, things like that. Like, those little details also add, you know, some additional layers and, just some fun in terms of like building out the characters or who they are as people. Because I do think, like, the other thing that this show does, like Homecoming, is that it reminds you that they're teens. You know, they still very much are adolescent characters, the core four. And so, you know, like, it even reminded me a little bit of like Archie in terms of how they hang out and interact with each other. And,
well, even the vibe and the look of it is very Archie, I think, inspired, right?
Yeah. And so, like, that works as well, because, you know, if you're not necessarily in the like punch 'em up fight sequences and action of it. And I think, like, a lot of shows, like, the strongest stuff is never what you're being sold on. Like, I think it's usually just character interactions that are more intriguing or worth investing in. And there's a lot of that in this, you know, like the dynamics of even Peter having a crush on Pearl, and, you know, her being a babysitter and that kind of stuff. And, you know, like, him judging Lonnie before he even gets to know him, because Lonnie, you know, there's this, not really a love triangle per se, but, like, you know, Lonnie is dating Pearl, but then when Peter meets Lonnie and starts to get to know him, he has a bit of a man crush on him. And, like, you really like both characters then. And, you know, like, you never root against anybody, and it complicates things more than it, you know, makes you feel like you have to oppose them.
Yeah, totally agree. I think the music kicks ass as well, is done really, really well.
They do abandon the musical. There's a couple musical, like, montages in the first few episodes, and I thought that was going to be a recurring sort of trend or signature throughout the series, and they kind of get away from it, which isn't a bad thing. It's not a criticism, but it was like, oh, are they going to incorporate, like, you know, this maybe alt top 40 song in a sequence to have like a soundtrack for the show? And again, they do, it's very front loaded. Like, it feels like the first couple of episodes, they put in a lot of music. And then after that, it's mostly score. And the actual opening title sequence, that is a remix of the 60s Spider-Man, that also gives you the origin story, because that's the thing that this does as well, is that it basically skips both Uncle Ben's death, but also Spider-Man going through the transformation, which is nice.
Yeah, you see it happen, but then it skips to, you know, 5 weeks later or something.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. Like, time, the way that time works on this show, there's a conversation that happens about maybe, like, I think halfway through the season, where they talk about events in the first episode, and it's like, oh, that was a year ago, you know, with Midtown High. And it feels like, oh, like, you know, they don't really emphasize how much time has gone by, except to just show you, like, oh, throughout the the season, you know, characters are going to certain events and what have you, but it's never like, you know, there's no title cards or anything telling you like a year.
Sure. Other than
by.
That one big skip. Yeah.
Yeah.
The score's done by, Leo Berenberg and Zach Robinson, who are the composers for Cobra Kai. So, that's sick. And yeah, I love that remixed, the song's called Neighbor Like Me, by the Math Club. It's already on Spotify and Apple Music. It kicks ass. Like, it's one of those. Yeah, maybe it's not as hype as the X-Men 97 theme, but like it's a non-skip for me. Like, it is like every episode when it would start and it, you got that.
And the new comic panel at the end. Like,
Oh my God. The title screens, Eric, you know, I love that shit. Like, every, without spoiling any of them, and there's nothing really to spoil, but the title sequence is worth watching each time. One, because the theme is a banger. Two, the intro is a fun montage intro to the show. And then the third point being each title card is like a comic book cover where it has the Marvel logo with a Spider-Man suit in the top left. And it has a new panel or a new element of whatever that episode is going to be about, as that. And then the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man thing. It fucking rocks, dude. Like, I love stuff like that. Like, just like little touches that make you kind of want to watch the intro to see what that title card's going to be and how they'll kind of incorporate that in each episode. Like, so that rocks as well. You mentioned some Easter eggs and stuff. Like, there is some fun MCU kind of things. Shout out to Zach Cherry, who's having a great kind of thing on. He's amazing in Severance, but it's funny. Nevis. She was kind of working on her art and stuff as I was watching this show. So she didn't really watch it from beginning to end, but she's my outlet sometimes of like the nerdy things that I'll pick up. So even when Zach Cherry's character, you see him for like a split second, which we've already seen people post online. So that's not really a spoiler, but right away I was like, oh, that's Zach Cherry's character, the do a flip Spider-Man, like from Homecoming. And he shows up obviously in Ant-Man and the Wasp and other Spider-Man stuff, but just seeing him for 2 seconds, or you see, like I mentioned, that they take moments from that Homecoming trilogy and kind of apply them. So there's a moment from Civil War, even, or a moment from No Way Home that is basically,
or Age of Ultron,
Age of Ultron, like panel for panel, what happens in the MCU, but it has this slight twist on it for what's happening. Like, the whole introduction to Norman here is ripped right from Civil War, and it's awesome and how it kind of plays on that. And then even with the Sokovia Accords and Civil War happening kind of like in the background of the events of this show, but without Tony coming to get Peter.
Yeah, they never replaced Spider-Man in that.
Yeah, which references. I think is interesting, yeah. Right? Because then who did Tony get to help for the Civil War battle? And then you kind of see those events and some other characters from the MCU play a role into this show as well. And I'm curious to see, I cannot wait for season 2, and they've already announced that they're going to do a season 3 as well. And I cannot wait to see how they incorporate Infinity War, Endgame. Like, are those events still going to happen? Like, does Peter get involved? I don't necessarily need it because of, we want this to be focused on Peter and his friends and Lonnie and stuff like that. Probably incorporate Kingpin and more, you know, street level stuff, which is, I think, what we want from some Spider-Man stuff, or even what we thought we would get from the next Spider-Man movie.
Marvel Spotlight.
Yeah. Well, based off the ending of No Way Home, we thought we'd get a more grounded Spider-Man, but because of what's going on with Doomsday and Secret Wars, are we going to get that, or is it going to be still more multiversal big stuff where this show will kind of tackle like the street level kind of elements? But you got to think the events of Infinity War are going to happen, right? Or because this universe has changed because of Peter, you know, whatever we see in the events of this show, Civil War is still happening as it happened in the movies, right? Like, yeah. And that's what makes me go, huh, I wonder what changes there, or if they even involve more of that stuff? Does Peter get involved with the Avengers? Does, you know, any of that stuff or more interaction with the Avengers? And
I always feel like it'd be background mostly the way that it
but you got to think if half the planet gets evaporated.
It changes where it's like, it's not Thanos and it's someone else and it's some other kind of apocalyptic situation.
But the Battle of New York did happen. Yes. Right. So like that's, it's the fun stuff as an MCU nerd and at this point an MCU historian, because
you're asking what if and you're not asking who cares.
I am though and that's a good thing, right? Yes. Like we say might go who cares when it comes to, you know, suspension of disbelief of some time travel elements and things like that, but I'm more intrigued because of this remixed universe, way more intrigued because it's a continuing thing rather than a one-off what if episode, right? Yes. Where in this I think it's so smart in the way that it utilizes the 15 plus years of the MCU that we've had now to its advantage of, it was so popular that we can now kind of take those elements and do something fresh in animation, but still, you know what events are happening in the background, and then you're intrigued by how will that play a part in this story or how will it change, right? And there's even some stuff in those final episodes that we've seen even in other animated series too that I'm like, why is that character there or in the background? And you're like, it, like, because that's happened in other shows too, X-Men 97 and stuff, where you're like, huh, where are they going with this, and is any of this going to play a part in Secret Wars and Doomsday? And it could, but I don't think it needs to. That's where I don't know if it actually does harm to it if they do try to include it, right? Like, maybe keep it its own thing. And but part of me goes, well, we are in the multiverse saga, you're showing us all these multiverse stories, like you'd think it might. Like, I'm not going to be mad if Coleman Domingo plays Norman Osborn in the MCU. Like, I wouldn't be mad at that, right? Like, if they Zach cherry pick things from this show and just go, you know, that worked really well in the show, why don't we incorporate that in? Because the theory we're getting in, the show's great, everyone watch it, it's fantastic. Now we do what Eric and I do, which is at the end of a review, talk about what we think could happen in the MCU. Like, if they do that reset of the MCU after Secret Wars, I wouldn't be surprised if you get a Coleman Domingo getting Zach Cherry picked out of the show and dropped in as Norman Osborn, right? Like, I think they might take elements from these things. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, not saying that something from X-Men 97 or whatever will get pulled in, but I don't know. I'm very intrigued, and stuff like this is a bright spot, especially in kind of a downtime. Not that everything's a downtime. Obviously, Deadpool and Wolverine did really, really well, whatever you think about that movie. But
financially speaking, yes, it did very, very well.
Yeah. And you know, and people do like that movie quite a bit.
Well, but it kept the boat afloat, right? But I think like this and X-Men 97 are the things that are the quality control of the MCU or the Marvel, the like, not the MCU in terms of like the overall Marvel aspect of it, because again, like, there is the feeling of like, is this a part of the MCU as a whole? Like, is this, you know, or is this relegated?
Well, it's part
to
of the
animation?
Multiverse, but yeah. it's part of the multiverse. It all is, right? It's just like everything we see, every Marvel thing that has ever happened is technically, I think, part of this multiverse, right? Whether it stays its own thing or gets pulled into the live action stuff is, or do we see this in Spider-Verse, right? Like, that's another thing is like, I wouldn't be surprised now if this show is popular enough and people like it, that eventually, you know, this character, maybe it's just a small cameo or whatever, right? Like in the next Spider-Verse movie, but it might be too far along. But I think that Spider-Verse movie's still 2 years out, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's probably a while out.
It's
so,
the severance of movie sequels.
Yeah. Shout out to Zach Cherry. Thank you, Eric. Any last thoughts before we
go? Yeah, I mean, I'll just kind of sum it up, you know, for the Rotten Tomatoes. fluid yet durable, your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man delivers an exciting what-if twist in the remixed animated series, preferring character-motivated conflict over convoluted plot. The Lincoln Parker parallels evoke corresponding empathy when facing great responsibility. That's another thing that I did laugh at. Lincoln Parker. Is
great. Yeah, Lincoln Parker is a great kind of...
that's a great like high school, you know, cover band name. Like that is amazing in the early 2000s.
Peter and Lonnie are in a band together. Yeah. Lincoln Parker. Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff, man. Yeah. I think it's great. I think you should absolutely watch it. And I hope people really, really do vibe with it. And I know Spider-Man animated series have always done pretty well. Like even the ones that were kind of, on, you know, Disney, whatever their Disney channel was, but they had that spectacular Spider-Man series that people really like. I know the MTV Spider-Man people didn't really love.
This reminds me of MTV. That was the other thing I wanted to quickly mention. Yeah. Like talking about the look of this show again, it's very similar to like the early 2000s MTV era of animation with Aeon Flux, Daria, Mission Hill, undergrads, like things like that. Like it kind of feels like it's not as you know, like it's not older teens, or it's not like trying to be like as what's the word I'm looking for, like it's not immature. Like I feel like undergrads and Mission Hill, like there's a very specific viewpoint.
Juvenile kind of thing.
Yeah. Where this isn't, but it does feel like, oh, this could be something that they would play in like an MTV animation block in the late 90s, early 2000s.
But don't you dare compare it to that MTV Spider-Man, because people don't like
that No. I'm comparing it more to like,
again, I know. Aria, just the Mission style, Hill. The vibe of that area.
Even the Max, era, you know, things like that stuff, you know.
But I'm so glad that we got another, you know, and because of the complicated history with the rights to Spider-Man, I think it's also very smart on Marvel, who owns the TV rights to Spider-Man, to be like, hey, we can just keep doing this show and we can play off the MCU. We can use all the Spider-Man villains. We can bring in our own
Kraven.
What they've done with the Spider-Man villains in these 10 episodes is 1,000 times better than anything Sony had done in any of theirs. And outside of the Homecoming, because I think Vulture and Mysterio and even Green Goblin and stuff like that, and Doc Ock in the last movie have been handled very well.
Yeah, but you're talking more about like the Sony Spider-Verse. With
the
like,
spinoff movies.
Yeah, the Venom, Kraven, Madame Web. Like if those characters were brought into this world, I wouldn't be against it. Where I think like there is now a taint of on them on live action possibilities, even if you were to reboot them within like say a Doomsday, or you know, like what's moving forward. So you know, like with this, like if Kraven shows up in season 3 of Your Friendly Neighbor,
which I wouldn't be surprised,
Spider-Man, I would be happy with that, because I think like they've done such a great job with every character, you know, big and small throughout. And again, like we haven't really talked much about it, but like even the dynamic between supporting characters, where the show, you know, isn't afraid to move away from Peter in certain episodes, whether it be Lonnie or like Nico and Harry Osborn becoming friends because Nico is so opposed to capitalism and you know, authoritarianism. And so you don't think like that dynamic is going to play out well, especially because he wants, you know, Peter wants all three of them to be friends and to have this dynamic together. And so it actually spends some time with those two characters forming a bond. And like, that is something where I think like a lot of shows wouldn't have the confidence to necessarily exclude their, you know, athlete character, their MVP character from what's going on. And for them to do that, it shows like they have, you know, the tenacity and, you know, they have thought out these characters that they can stand on their own and be, you know, in at least 2 or 3 scenes without really even referencing any action or, you know, bigger scale moments. Yeah. So that's exciting too.
Man, the show rocks. I can't wait for season 2. Can't wait for more. Marvel Animation is absolutely crushing it. And, you know, that's even with What If stumbling a little bit. But yeah. I've enjoyed elements of What If. But I think
What If struggled, right? Like, that was the thing. Yeah. Like, we've talked about this because it felt like at the end of every season of What If, they were kind of trying to do what this is, where the last couple of episodes, instead of being all anthology, would actually have a continuation or connective tissue in bringing in characters that we've seen in the other episodes. Where, like, I think, like, even if you did, like, say, your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man series of Iron Man, you know, and focus it on Iron Man, and maybe it would be bringing in some of the Civil War stuff, but doing his own world, but only doing like one season. Like, your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man's obviously, you know, been renewed for three seasons, and season two is in development as we're talking. But I could see them just doing like a one-off full season of one character with one really great story.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't have to be anymore. More like Watchmen, but animated.
Do you think they're more likely to keep? So what we just talked about with the 97 universe, now your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man universe, if they were, now we have Eyes of Wakanda coming out later this year too, which is more actual MCU, but animated, I believe, from the same, in the live action universe, it's the same universe. I think so. We haven't seen anything. And Marvel Zombies being its, you know, spinoff of What If. If they were to do an Iron Man show or something like that, do you think they keep it in the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man universe now because it's that fresh but familiar MCU, or do they do another, like, its own universe kind of thing?
I almost think it depends on the animation style itself.
Yeah.
Like, if they decide to go with the 3D cell animation here, but
then you keep it in this universe.
Then you keep it in the universe because there's a level of consistency. But if you decide, because I was reading that, like, you know, the creators of this were not beholden to other versions of animation. So it could be the same thing where it's like, oh, well, maybe they do their own complete, you know, start from scratch and build universe, the character and the universe and the style of animation that they want to reflect. But if they decide they want to go the same route with the animation itself, then maybe they do keep it in. So I think, like, and also I think they would have to have a conversation with the people involved in this, because then it would be, you know, encroaching on, you know, their world and their creative endeavors. So I think, like, that's
three shared universes. There's the 90s universe, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man universe, live action universe. I think those are the three that they should continue with. Now that I've seen it, you get too many separate things. And I think that, I mean, again, it can be its own thing, but I think if you want to continue, I think people like the shared universe characters showing up and having, and in animation, I think it's so much easier to do. Although an animated series is obviously very hard to make and takes years and years and years. But if I was running things, those are the three that I think have worked so well. And Marvel Zombies, I think, is going to be a one-off thing, right? I'm glad it's getting its
own season. I hope it is, because it seems like Marvel has a hard time sort of deciding, like, where to end or when to end. Like, even with, like, the live action stuff, like, it feels like, okay, it feels like Moon Knight is done, it, you know, in terms of, like, like, as a series, like, but they keep it open-ended, and, you know, like, the character will obviously come back in
Midnight Suns and stuff like that.
But in terms of, like, that's what I'm talking about with, like, if they do more of these types of animated shows, they don't necessarily have to be more than one season. If even if they are successful or critically acclaimed,
you could,
one and done is fine. It doesn't,
or even an episode, dude, you could have a Tony Stark episode in friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. You don't even necessarily have to do, like, you could go into the other heroes or an Avengers series.
Well, they did that on the 90s show too, right? Because Iron Man would show up, Doctor Strange showed up, Hulk would show up. There was an episode with James Rhodes, like, you know, like,
and I think just continue to do that kind of stuff, and then you don't necessarily even need its own series, and then you can keep playing off of the elements of the MCU by showing why this universe is unique and different. And because I think even just adding in people like a Norman Osborn or a Otto Octavius and stuff like that, like, just adds an element that can completely change the trajectory of what that universe is compared to the live action one. So yeah, it kicks ass. So please go watch it. I hope this does super well. I cannot wait for season two. I hope, based on what we've heard, they said that they've already have the scripts for season two. They're halfway through the animatics. So hopefully it's not that long of a wait. I hope it's like a next year thing. I hope we don't have to wait 2 years for seasons. I want to get back to the, I agree. We were talking off air before this of television. I think both with Squid Game and Severance coming back recently, those were long waits between those two seasons. And I think that's in a movie sense. I don't know. I think I'm like almost fine with waiting a couple years, because usually it's like a 2 hour, 3 hour story. And then, but when you have 10 plus hours of storytelling, and then you're having me wait 3 years in between seasons, like I miss the days of television being a yearly kind of thing. But then I also am on the other side of being like, take your time, make sure it's great, have a great story, come like back when you're ready.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Come back when you're ready. And I'm also fine with that, but I really hope sometimes you lose momentum too, right? Like yeah. I do feel like Squid Game season two, I haven't heard many people talk about. Like it came out kind of right after Christmas, and I think most people feel how I thought, which was like, it's good. Like I enjoyed it. It's better than I almost expected it to. It didn't need a second season.
Well, you're competing against like, other things, right? Like that's the yeah. problem here where, you know, like you said, you lose momentum, but it's also, it's like when you do come back, there's about like 30 other things that have been released since, you know, you've been away when it comes to television. And so now the market is so saturated and you're competing yeah. against all these other TV shows that it's like, you know, the thing that was popular then maybe isn't popular now.
But we're probably going to get 2 year waits, because you got to think we're not getting X-Men 97 this year, right? We're going to get a second season probably next year, unless it's like late this year and they haven't said anything. But it looks like 2 year waits in between this, which I'd rather them build up, you know, a little bit of runway before yeah. they release a first season.
That like in the Fast and Furious.
Yeah, that extra long runway from Fast 7, 6.
I think it's 6.
That infinitely long runway, because I think Invincible learned as well from that weird gap in between the break of the seasons. They lost a lot of momentum or the part one and part two that they did, which was not great and things like that. But this very much feels like a complete season. There's, you know, a full arc. Full character arcs, yet it sets up things for the future. It's great. Please, please, please go watch it. Thank you all for listening. We really do appreciate it. We have a couple mega episodes out right now that you guys can go listen to. We have a 3.5 hour long Best Movies of 2024 episode where Eric and I go through our top 10 movies of the year each. We have a 3 hour plus episode of our most anticipated films of 2025 that just dropped a couple days ago. So if you guys want to go listen to that, that's my favorite episode we do. We kind of go through the entire year of movies and every single movie that might come out. And then we kind of draft a top 25 most anticipated films. If you don't want to listen to the 3 hour episode, you can also go to our letterbox, which is Untitled_Movies. The full list is up there as well. Eric has a great interview with Sookyun Lee for Paying for It that you guys can check out. That's like a full hour long episode where Eric. there's tons of stuff. And then we have a review for Companion coming out this week as well. So we have been very busy for the end of January. We have a Netflix preview event, a Captain America, Brave New World press conference we'll be covering. I still want to talk about WWE Raw in LA. I still want to talk about Disneyland. So we'll be very busy over the next, few months at the beginning of the year. Which is fun, which is exciting. So please go check out all of that on YouTube, podcast services, Letterboxd, which is Untitled_Movies. Follow myself at Matt Rohrbeck, Eric at EM6211, or Eric Marchin. You know, just search our names on your service of choice. Go check out Eric's reviews and interviews and shows over on RogersTV.com/CinemaScene. And yeah, I think that's it, buddy.
Yep.
Until next time.
Spider-Man pops his cherry.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Bye.